Oh, these are my classmates.
Yes, this is a list of the class of 1956.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could go through it and mention a few names and any stories and anyone we should talk to.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure. Yes.
Well, is this on?
Yes, we're on, and we're back on. And I only recognized a few names. I recognized Ray Fumare, of course.
Yeah.
And Braidwood, I think.
Tom Braidwood. Peter Butler is dead. He was an outstanding courtroom lawyer. Hamish Cameron. It was an outstanding corporate lawyer. He's retired. He started a book club, which I'm a member. Stu Klein is still working downtown. There's about eight of us still working. And Chuck Liu, who should be on here, L-E-W, organizes a lunch twice a year in Chinatown when those of us still work and get together. John Spencer and Dunk Shaw were judges, and they're now both retired, but. Dunk works for his old law firm, or with his old law firm now in retirement, so he joins our luncheons. Graham McKenzie is retired, but no, he actually has retired. He attended the last luncheon and said he actually has retired. He practiced with Tom Braidwood for a long time, and Tom, you will know, was a prominent judge and royal commissioner. Stanley R. Bassford was Ron Bassford. He's dead now, but he was a prominent liberal politico at law school, and then, of course, had a career in politics and was a cabinet minister. He actually had a period as Minister of Justice.
Was he from the Comox Valley?
I think he was, but I'm not sure.
I've come across him in my work there.
Ron Bray is dead. He was a prominent lawyer. Richard Dandria is dead. He was my best friend in law school. We roomed together at Fort Camp. Mm-hmm. He went up to practice in Trail, which was his home, and became a provincial court judge there. But he died about 1983 or 4, died still in his 50s. And Nicky Drossos was a judge, and he's retired. Ken Faucus was a judge. He died Bob Guile is dead. No, he was an usher at my wedding. Bud Hollenrake was a judge. He had the the room next to Richard Dandria and me in Fort Camp. Bob Hutchison was a judge. He's now retired in Victoria. And Brent Kenny is still working full time, and he comes to the lunches, and he's the youngest of us. I think I'm the second youngest. Rafe Mayer, you know, I haven't seen some of these fellows for years, Derek Stanfield. He's still practicing, I think, in Seashells, and he comes to our lunches. And I think the, everybody else on that second page is dead now. So you're only interviewing the living. And
yes,
you should interview Tom Braidwood. He's had a distinguished and varied career.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only three women in the class. You could interview Patsy Byrne, who became a provincial court judge, and Mrs. Evans, who Rendina Hosey, who should be on here somewhere. I think that's M.R.K. Hosey, H.O.S.S.I.E. She was the gold medalist in our class. She was the daughter of a very distinguished lawyer.
Is the spelling right there? It looks
yes,
like
it's
it should
right,
be
it's
one.
Right, it's right. And her brother was in the class. But Rendina led the class in third year. Mrs. Evans was second, and I was third. So I led all the men in the class.
Yeah.
And Rendina, I'm sure, is retired now, living in Penticton, but you could talk to her. Very lovely person. And Mrs. Evans, I hate to say it, I just don't know whether she's alive or dead.
I could look her up, maybe.
But, and you could talk to Stu Klein. He was our class president. And his father was J.V. Klein.
Right.
Jack Barbo may still be alive. He was a tax lawyer. Ron Jeffson's dead. And many of these others I don't know. Terry Nichols is dead. George Rupanos, I think he's still alive. He had his law degree and became a teacher. And he taught at Britannia. And I saw him recently somewhere. But he would be interesting because he didn't go into law.
Mm-hmm.
He became a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
what was the curriculum like, and what and the professors? What do you?
Well, I let me just. I was very happy to go to law school. I enjoyed it. And we all wore jackets and ties in those days to school. And we were welcomed by Dean Curtis, and I'm sure others have talked about Dean Curtis, and J.O. Wilson, who was then a judge of the Supreme Court of BC, gave a speech introducing us to the law on our first day, and he was Chief Justice when I became a judge in November 1971, and much revered. He was at that time, I think, the only judge who had never graduated from university, but he was the most learned among us and wrote much better than any of us.
What was his training, if he hadn't?
Well, he was taught the. You should speak to Jim Taylor, who wasn't in our class, but he started on a biography of J.O.
Hmm.
Wilson, and Bob Guile was J.O. Wilson's nephew. Bob started on a biography, but he's dead. And I think Jim carried it on. But we were told that J.O. Learned the classics at his mother's knee in somewhere in the Kootenays. Then he practiced in Prince George and Ashcroft with his father during the Depression. And I appeared before him often. He was a very able judge. And we became friends when he was Chief Justice. We were both interested in literature and law, and I mean, not close friends, but he was much revered by everyone who was on the court in those days. Anyway, at law school, we had, I think, only 5 or 6 permanent professors, and lawyers came from downtown as adjuncts to fill up the curriculum, and I enjoyed it. You know, when you're introduced to a subject, it's all new and quite exciting. But I've had occasion to reflect since that time about the curriculum. My career as a lawyer started, I started out in criminal law and labor law, which we covered in those days, but then I was, I think it's fair to say, one of the pioneers in the development of Aboriginal law and in environmental law. And looking back on it, it's amazing that I went to law school for 3 years in the mid-50s, and nobody ever discussed the question, well, what about the original people of this province? Don't they have some kind of rights? They lived on Indian reserves and they were marginalized, and subject never came up, and we students never raised it. Never occurred to us, well, what about this?
It was all settled.
Well, it wasn't settled, it was dormant, I think, but it didn't interest the law schools. It didn't interest the legal profession. And Indians encountered the courts usually as persons charged with crimes, and that was about their only contact with the law, and that was the only contact lawyers had with them. And about when I started my own law practice in 1963, I had been with a firm, Shulman Tupper and Company, who were very good to me. I was with them, I articled with them and practiced with them for 5 years. Then I was elected to Parliament in 62, and I lost my seat only 9 or 10 months later and decided to open my own practice. Mm-hmm. And a woman named Maisie Hurley, who had, who was on the criminal side, I had gone for advice to an older lawyer named Tom Hurley, who was then about the age I am now, is in his late 70s. And he was a very distinguished criminal lawyer, had argued some important cases in the Supreme Court of Canada. But he, the fact is he was an alcoholic, but he still functioned. And he was very, well, I shouldn't say he was an alcoholic. He was a man who liked to take a drink, and we would convene at a beer parlor to talk about my cases. He was always very helpful. We became friends, and I used to drive him home from time to time, and got to know his wife, who was a great champion of the Indian people. And after I opened my own practice, she brought me, she came in, and she had Mrs. Renee Rogers of the Rogers Sugar family with her. And she told me about two young Indian men charged with hunting out of season in Nanaimo. And she had Mrs. Rogers there to provide the money for their fines to be paid, since they were actually serving time in prison in lieu of paying a fine of $100 or something. And I went to Nanaimo to talk to them, and I met the elders, and they talked about, they had a treaty. I looked into it, it turned out they had a treaty. There were, Governor Douglas had signed 8 or 9 or 10 treaties in the 1850s with Indians on southern Vancouver Island. A settlement proceeded from Victoria up the east side of the island, and the treaties had never been enforced. They just sat in the archives as curiosities. And I had just started my practice, so I had a lot of time, and I got to know Wilson Duff, who was the first anthropologist, the first forensic anthropologist we ever had in this province or in this country, and the provincial archivist, who was an historian, Willard Ireland. I called them both as witnesses to establish the treaty and the occupation of the Nanaimo Indians of the area covered by the treaty, because it was just a blank piece of paper with some X's on it. And we found dispatches of Governor Douglas saying that he had done this and the promises he made to them. I mean, he had run out of forms. The colonial department in London sent out forms that you could have the Indians sign. There were treaties. Anyway, that went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, and I won it. And I raised along the way the whole question of Aboriginal title, because the Crown said, oh, this isn't a treaty, this is not unenforceable. So I developed the argument, well, if it's not a treaty, then we still have Aboriginal title and Aboriginal rights to hunt and fish that that exist independently of any treaty. And Justice Norris, mm-hmm. in the Court of Appeal, he went into that at great length. The other judges really dealt with it on the basis, yes, you have a treaty. We won that 3-2 in the Court of Appeal, and in the Supreme Court of Canada, they said this is a treaty. That was,
what was the case called?
Oh, Regina against White and Bob. And there was a 40th anniversary of the White and Bob case at the Nanaimo in 2005, I think it was. And Clifford White and David Bob were there. They had been in their 20s, and I was still 29 or 30 when we did the case. So I met them for the first time in the passage of 40 years. And but what was charming is a student at UVic Law School, whose name was White, I think he was a nephew of one of the two accused persons whose names had, you know, gone with the case. He had done a paper at law school on the significance of the decision, Regina against White and Bob, and there were a number of law students there from UVic and a number of professors, and of course many people from the Nanaimo First Nation. So that was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And because that case was well publicized, it meant that I acquired a name as a defender of the Indian cause. And Vanishka came in to see me, and Frank Culler, who was president of the Nisshoan Tribal Council, and the four chiefs of the four villages. One of the chiefs was Jimmy Gosnell, whose younger brother, Joe Gosnell, later became the first president of the Nisshoan government in 2000 after the treaty came into force. But anyway, I had an office in the old Inns of Court building that Howe and Georgia, just a two-story building where the Pacific, there's a hotel there, what's it called? Big hotel. The Four Seasons is, and it was a pretty Spartan office. And I had a secretary, and my mother worked for me as the bookkeeper. And she was widowed then, and she lived with us and came to work with me every day. And anyway, when the Frank Calder and the four chiefs came into my office, I don't think there were enough chairs for them. Anyway, they said, "You are the young lawyer who took that case in the Nanaimo, and we want you to sue the government to establish our Aboriginal title."
Did they have a treaty too, or
no? No, no. The only Southern Vancouver Island was the only place where treaties were signed, and Treaty 8, an overlap from the prairies in northeastern BC, but BC was in a sense unique in that. The old Governor Douglas always wanted treaties to be signed everywhere, but the legislature of the old colony of Vancouver Island, then the colony of BC, then the United Colony, wouldn't do it. And when we became a province, the provincial government wouldn't do it. And that remained the situation for more than 100 years. So in 1967 or thereabouts, or 66, I think, we launched a lawsuit for the Nisga, the Tribal Council, and the four bands along the Nass River against the province for a declaration that their Aboriginal title had never been extinguished. And that was heard in the Supreme Court in 1971. And in 1973, they handed down their decision. They were divided 3-3, but they agreed, all of them, that Aboriginal title was a part of Canadian law. Three of them said it had been extinguished in British Columbia before BC entered Confederation. The other three, led by Emmett Hall, who wrote the principal judgment, said, "No, no, it still exists today." The seventh judge went off on a point of procedure against us, and we lost the case 4-3. But Gérard Laforêt, who later became a judge of the Supreme Court of Canada, was then principal advisor in the Department of Justice on this very subject. The federal government, and he's written a reminiscence that's there was a 30th anniversary of the Calder case at UVic, I think it was at UVic, yes, at UVic 10 years ago, because the 40th anniversary is coming up in March next year, and they just asked me to come and give the keynote. But anyway, at the 30th anniversary, number of papers given by various people and professors and historians and so on. And Gérard Laforêt was then retired from the Supreme Court of Canada. He gave a paper explaining that when that court was, the Supreme Court was divided 3-3, he advised the Minister of Justice and the Prime Minister, then better view was that of Emmett Hall, Justice Emmett Hall. And the government acted on that, and they decided then to settle land claims wherever there were no treaties in Canada, and that included Quebec, the Northwest Territories, including what is now known as the Yukon and BC. And that's why you have treaties now pretty much covering Quebec, Nunavut, well, 80% of the Northwest Territories, all of the Yukon, and of course the process is underway in BC with the Nisga Treaty having been signed, and now the treaty in Tsawwassen and some others are all in train. But all of that emanated from that visit to my little law office in 65. Yes, I won White and Bob in 65, so it must have been in 66 that we started the Nisga case. By the way, the White and Bob case, just a few months ago, I was invited to speak at a banquet in Nanaimo at the university there. What's it called? You would know.
VIU, Vancouver Island.
Yeah, it used to be Malaspina. And they had a 2-day conference. I just went over for the second day and spoke at their banquet. But I sat in for a while and realized they had historians there, Aboriginal leaders, all discussing the significance of the White and Bob case, which originated in 1963 when these two young guys went out hunting and were charged with hunting on season. And the treaty emerged from that. Anyway, those were fascinating cases. And
What sort of evidence did the Nisga table in the Calder case? Was it an oral history or?
We had, once again, we had Wilson Duff to talk about the Nisga use and occupation of the region. And I think we must have had the archivist too, Willard Ireland. He was an historian. We lost the case at the trial. We lost it in the BC Court of Appeal, and then we had this divided outcome in the Supreme Court of Canada, which actually, since the judgment of Justice Emmett Hall was adopted by the federal government, has led to half of the landmass of Canada now being the subject of land claim settlements, which is the modern expression for treaties. Anyway, that's was. But the irony is, you're asking me about law school.
Yeah.
They've never studied that stuff in law school. Now they do now, and UBC Law School, I think, is perhaps the leading school in Canada with regard to the strength of its faculty in the subject of Aboriginal rights. And Michael Jackson is still there. Ken Lissick was the dean. He was a very important authority on this very subject. Doug Sanders, who briefly practiced with me when I set up my own office, who was there for many years studying and teaching this. I was at the law school a month ago because, among other things, I did the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry, and that was in from 74 to 77. But there is now a unit in the Northwest Territories Department of Education covering the Berger Inquiry. So all students in grade 11 in the Northwest Territories study this, but in ways that I still don't comprehend. It's interactive. They have me on Skype and they can ask me questions. Then they take sides on the whole question. Should there be a pipeline? What about Aboriginal rights? What about the environment? And they write essays on each side, and then they become the judge. They are Judge Berger, and they write a report. I mean, not, you know. And now this unit is it's called the Inquiry Exhibition, and it's going across the country. It started at UBC Law School, and they had about 300 students from around the university who came to participate. And I went out to give a little speech opening the thing. And the dean introduced me, and I said, how many original students do you have in the law school? And she said, oh, about 50. And when I went there, there weren't any. Well, there was one, Alf Scow, who would be a year ahead of me. I think he graduated after me. But he's still alive. You should talk to him. He was never in my class, but he was the only law student, the first and only for a long time. And then he became a provincial court judge. But and at this, just the other day when I was there to open this thing, I met so many able young Aboriginal people studying law, and all of them very confident. This is where we belong, you know. This is our law. This is, I mean, they weren't, anyway, it was great to see. And so.
Well, we often, in these interviews, we even anticipated one of the questions, because we ask people what the greatest change is in their career. But obviously the emergence of Aboriginal law is a,
and the emergence of environmental law,
and
the emergence of, I don't know if this is the right word for it, poverty law, but, you know, there's a whole area of law where people need legal advice in connection with applying for welfare. Maybe they get it, maybe they're denied. Workers' compensation. Unemployment insurance. You know, these are legal labyrinths out there that most ordinary folks can't navigate. And I got into it because in my first 5 years in law practice, I in 1959 I represented the iron workers in the great dispute about a strike on the new Second Narrows Bridge then under construction. And I that summer I was in court every day, and the case was in the papers, and every day the judge threatened to throw me into prison. And in due course I won the case in the Court of Appeals. So
what was the what was that case about?
Well, look,
or shouldn't I?
No, I'll tell you what.
Can of worms.
I'm going to give you a copy of a book I wrote about my career, since you've given me one.
Great.
I finished it about 8 or 9 years ago, but a lot of this stuff is in there. I wrote about it, and it was on the BC bestseller list for, I don't know, a month or two.
Thank you.
I'll just get it.
All right. Just gone to get a book from his office, and he'll be back here in a minute. We are in a boardroom in his law offices.
That and some of these anecdotes, not really about my father, but some of those others, I were in here.
Excellent.
And this, A Bridge Too Far, that's the...
Keep
that with my compliments. And,
thank you.
In fact, we've got to conclude this before too long.
Sure.
But if you wanted to come back and
yes,
ask anything more after you've read that...
Thanks, yes, I will. I am going to turn this off.